We talk a lot on this show about cities because cities really are some of the most interesting complex systems we have out there. A lot of the concepts we use in complex systems we see in cities. And cities also tend to provide a really rich data set for analysis. So we've talked to Jeff West about cities, particularly from a scaling perspective. And we've also talked to Luis Betancourt about cities as social reactors. Now, Luis is a professor at the University of Chicago, and he's also an external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. And he talked to us before about how we tend to think of cities as a collection of buildings. But in fact, cities are not that. Cities are social reactors. Their job is to bring us together to interact with one another. Now, in this episode, we're going to look at the city from an economic perspective because both Luis and I share a really interesting background in that both of us grew up in countries that went through significant economic booms. So as my accent no doubt gives me away, I'm Irish originally, and I lived through the Celtic Tiger, very big economic boom in Ireland. Similarly, Luis moved through an economic boom in Portugal. Now, what is it that actually drives this sort of economic progress? What's behind it? Well, in this episode, we're going to look at the role of the city as a driver in economic change. And we're going to talk specifically about something magical that a city allows us to do. And that is that it allows us to specialize. This is Simplifying Complexity, a podcast where we explore the underlying principles of complex systems. Systems that seem to defy our rational view of the world, like economies, ecologies, or even you or me. I'm forensic engineer Sean Brady, and I'll be your host. Luis, welcome back on the show.
Thank you, Sean. It's a great pleasure to be back.
And the last episode you were on, you talked all about cities and we talked about how cities work and how some of the problems of cities. In this episode, we're going to have a what we hope is a wide-ranging conversation where we talk about cities again, we talk about the economy. And we have spoken briefly before together about I'm from Ireland, you're from Portugal. Both countries went through a huge economic change in our younger years. And we could look at those as purely economic and we could try and write the maths for them. But when you put a complexity lens on it, particularly from a city's perspective, you get a different story.
Yes, absolutely. I think, again, you have the embodied economy, so to speak. And by embodied, I mean embodied in people, individuals, the way they live. That should be pretty clear, right? That people have purely economically, would say they have more purchasing power, they consume and produce more, et cetera. So that's tangible. But then you have to take the next step. How do they do that? Where are they doing this? And so they often are doing this in a city, big or small, and within organizations, right? Firms, but also other organizations that allow that sort of dynamics to be supported and work. And pretty soon you're having a conversation, a little bit like we were having in the last episode, about the city having certain supporting structures, which are places to live, infrastructure, services that allow us to function and to dedicate time then to socioeconomic activity. And then we may choose to put the focus on the socioeconomic activity, but we shouldn't lose track of all the scaffolding that needs to be there to begin with. And then the economic set of interactions have their own structure, which are also very interesting. So what happens in cities when you go and start looking at larger cities, which, as we discussed last time, tend to be more productive per capita, also more expensive per capita, is that you have a process of specialization that people do narrower job, what feels like narrower job to more specialized jobs, broadcaster, scientist, et cetera, and so on. But many weird things, right? You can be like a brain surgeon or an opera singer, right? I mean, who called for that, right? But it's just these things develop and they exist. And many other weird things that probably we don't even know about, but that people do and thrive doing. And then why did that happen, right? So again, you're back to classical economics where we have this broader sense of the embedding of the economy. And we observe, this is also a perspective in complex systems, often called economic complexity, where it also observes that richer places are more specialized, the more where you have a lot of these specializations being more interdependent in a network. But this is just generally, you know, it goes back to any observation about the fabric, if you will, the structure of a developed economy or a rich economy. So it's an interesting puzzle. Why exactly that happens? Why is it necessary? And this goes back to the explanation that followed a little bit in economics. But again, that Adam Smith basically describes, though not mathematically, is that as people are able to connect, as you decrease the costs of interaction, he's thinking a lot about transportation, but we can also think in other ways, then people are able to specialize. And as they specialize, they become better at what they do. They become a better cook, a better podcaster, a better scientist or whatever, right? Whether if you're doing 100 things, you cannot be very good at any of them, which you have to do if you don't have anyone around you doing those other things that you're not doing. So in a city, this all becomes possible. And in a larger city, because you have more people, more activities, it becomes deeper and deeper. And what's special about this from a modern perspective is that it's not only that it's possible in the sense that people have enough interactions that the things that they don't do anymore are done by others around them. So you can have a delicious meal always in a great city, right? Even though none of us, me anyway, are a great cook. But that's great because somebody is, right? And that's just the obvious example. That goes with so many other things. So what's interesting, right, is that when I said this person's a great cook, it really means that they're better at what they do. They have more information. They have maybe talent or experience that allow them to get to that level of quality of what they can do. And the idea is that if you spend more time on something, it's inevitable. People are learning animals, and we get better at things, right? If nothing else from experience, but of course, then we have formal channels to be educated and trying to do that better as well. And then we get tested, right? If we're a lousy cook in a great city, you're toast, right? You have to go do something else. So all this contributes to a complicated network of functions that not only embeds all these functions in an interesting, interdependent way, but also promotes learning, promotes invention, promotes innovation, promotes great cooks and great everything. A friend of mine always says they're great. So he says, you know, a great city is a place where you can do whatever you want, but you have to do it expletive really well. So that happens. But what happens in a society like this, in an economy like this, is that there's more knowledge than in a society where each person does everything. And a lot of this has to do with the depth of that knowledge. That if a person does everything, every person is more or less the same. They're trying to do everything. But the depth of any dimension of that knowledge, how good you are as an entertainer or as a cook or as a researcher, is much shallower. So there's no new knowledge, or there's rarely new knowledge at that sense. You cannot really create a brain surgeon or an opera singer without a lot of supporting structure. So that's what happens. So these societies have a lot more knowledge, have a lot more complementarities in which people can service each other and export also to outside the city and outside the nation, because they do something unique and desirable. And this is wealth. This is the way it works. It's a lot of it is about knowledge and social structure and things that people appreciate. So it's very tangible, and go out and experience it, because that's really what it is. That's development.
I've never heard quite explain that before, and it's fantastic that, you know, the city creates this melting pot for the specialization, and the specialization creates essentially the progress and the wealth. So what happened in Portugal from your side? Where did Portugal come from? Where did it end up? And what was the role of the city in that, which we've obviously covered a bit?
Yeah, I don't dare quite say so much about Ireland, though I think there's a somewhat parallel story, but obviously also with differences. But Portugal, Ireland, they're quite peripheral countries within Europe, right? Geographically, certainly, but I think also culturally, economically, in certain ways. Places where for a long time, for centuries at least, until the present era, people used to leave from to go elsewhere to try their luck and so on. Places that had remained fairly rural, even though they had some cities, but on the whole. And compared to other places, because of that, relatively, forgive me, but unsophisticated in the sense of ultimately the kind of knowledge and so on and expertise that they had. Not to say that some people were not extraordinary, but, you know, as a whole, I think it's fair to say. So what happened was that a series of transformations allowed these countries and places to become more central. In some sense, what we were saying last time, better connected, better able to create these interdependencies, first as entire countries relative to Europe and relative to a more globalizing world. I think Ireland benefited a lot from being an English-speaking place with a decent education and then also a financial center of its kind. So that made a huge difference for a relatively small country, but also having a huge diaspora of people who have experience of the world, right? And a lot of channels from which you could get knowledge. And Portugal, even though obviously it's not primarily an English-speaking country, went from being a completely closed extractive economy in relation to an empire until 1974. So a place that basically did not promote knowledge or interaction or a cosmopolitan outlook, to flipping and becoming the opposite, a place where people come to, first from a lot of places that speak Portuguese, which is also in some sense culturally important, but then also becoming a beautiful place within Europe that with rising living standards and so on. But it took a whole generation, sort of my generation, after that political change, an investment in education, investment in infrastructure, all the things that we're discussing yesterday, that became supportive, and they took a generation to be built, but that now are more or less there, not perfectly, but they're more or less there. It can support now this kind of different experience of being a creative socioeconomic being to a large extent that was possible before. But, you know, even as I was born, and, you know, that probably a third of the population was illiterate, half the population didn't have piped water or sanitation. It was really a huge transformation. And central to all this has been the growth of cities and urbanization. So when people come, particularly from abroad or from far away, where do they go? Where do young people go? Where does somebody with an idea go? They have to go to a city. And so Lisbon in particular became a relatively large city. I mean, not so large for compared to Asia or so on, but it's 3 million people, very cosmopolitan. Very interesting because it layers not only a lot of different histories, but also now different cultures. And, you know, it has a little California feel that's kind of very desirable, and started to have a tech scene and a music scene. And so, you know, all that helped. And so now it's a wonderful place to be. You know, there's still some way to go. The country's still very unequal and so on, but it's made a huge difference already. But again, the centrality, not only within the country and the population, that allows people to assume new roles, assume more creative roles, have a more interconnected society that's better supported. All this is still work in progress, frankly, in Portugal, but it's much, much better than it ever was. But then also at a different scale, this complex systems have many scales, right? Systems of systems. It's also much more central within Europe and within sort of a more globalizing world. And that also made a huge difference, I think, for both countries.
And what do you mean by more central in Europe? How did the two of them go from being peripheral?
I don't mean that obviously geographically, but I mean in terms of people coming and going. In my generation, it was a huge thing that we could, with European Union, people could just go and live and work anywhere within Europe. And so there's been a lot of people coming and going with more experience, not only to go study, which was maybe more common, but also to go work and so on, but also people from Europe wanting to start to come to Portugal, which was new. That started a little bit along some economic gradients like Eastern Europe and so on. But then as it became sort of more popular and so on and higher living standards, then, for example, the tech boom that became, I think that was also true for Ireland, a lot of people could work remotely and go to the beach and surf at the same time, which you can't do in many places in Europe, but you can in Portugal. You know, with things like this, where it's a bit of a California effect, where you can have an attractive lifestyle and do a very advanced job, at least in the great scheme of things, that didn't used to be possible. We either had one or the other, which meant that none of them was very good in the extreme. But, you know, but once you can have both, then it makes a huge difference. And I think that's just created a whole more cosmopolitan outlook that allows a lot of other possibilities to be explored. Again, you know, it's something that keeps changing, but I think also it's definitely created a dynamic of change that is there now. Already has created an enormous transformation, but it took a long time. And it took creating a lot of these latent connections in terms of education, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of transportation systems, all kinds of things that allow then these creative connections to be manifested later on. We see this also with development patterns in Asian countries and so on. Usually it takes a generation of investment, and then you have what seems to be magic in terms of economic change.
And I mean, to really attempt to simplify that, Luis, I mean, I've never heard it put together like this before, that if you get the education right, people are now able to communicate with each other and you can get good information flow. And if you go, and that's a kind of it's essentially a type of infrastructure. And then you can get real infrastructure put in so you can get more people together. And then you can do this stuff like the European Union did, which is essentially the infrastructure that you can now travel and work. And by building all that, you're just creating these melting pots of cities that we talked about in the last episode. And once we ramp up those interactions between people, that allows specialization, that allows people to get really, really good at what they do. So you end up with a country made up of cities where there's incredible specialization that really makes it thrive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very dynamical process, right? Because now it becomes open-ended. And the trick often is that it's inclusive enough, right? That enough people can participate in that process, which is not always simple. And it's always a work in progress. I think we're very conscious of that. But yes, once that is in motion, as you described, then a society has a lot of knowledge. It's very distributed. It's very interdependent. It depends on all the enabling factors that these connections and productive latent ideas to be there. But once these things start coming together, then it feels like, wow, you know, it's all kinds of things become possible. And it becomes very exciting.
So when you take this view, what are the, what you describe as the naive thoughts on economic development? What are the theories that people talk about that are very inconsistent with this sort of view of economic development from a complex systems perspective?
Well, I think the people that think about economic development, emphasis on development or economic growth, they already have something in their minds that is a little bit different from more, I guess, neoclassic economics, which is more how markets work and produce certain equilibria. So in a more static view, there's a certain sense of efficiency and optimality, which is a little simplistic, but nevertheless. So that perspective of markets working and being good aggregators of information is more the neoclassic perspective. I think that has its limitations, that particularly in complex systems, but also in economics, as people have come to have a more sophisticated view of what information is and how it's distributed, frankly, the kind of things we started to talk about, you know, how people have information become more specialized. This is also depends on interdependency. So then you have groups and firms and so on. That has to do with this distributed, but also dynamical view of information. So it's not purely a market thing. I think that picture is a little bit more up for grabs and there are interesting developments. But going back to what you asked, going back to development, then the question is, what are the main channels that do promote development? And I think even a few decades ago, not long ago, we were talking a lot about structural changes, changing the banking system or changing sort of the way the government does business. Often, you know, a typical set of advice was to create more market mechanisms such that people can make what was supposed to be better choices. So in the US, for example, we have a lot of policies that even in social realms, where somebody, instead of getting social housing, for example, they may get a check with the expectation that somebody with a check will make better choices than being assigned to a subset of possibilities that are created as physical spaces in the city. I think, you know, we could have a long conversation about this, about what's good and bad about it. You could think that are good things, but usually these checks are not such big checks that they actually solve the problem and people are still boxed in and they often cannot make great decisions and the results are underwhelming. But that's kind of the expectation that somehow bottom up with enough economic choice, you'll get development. What I'm saying here is that it takes a lot more structure than that. It takes creating, I think it's not controversial, but you need to have education, you need to have infrastructure. But you need to have it not just in those vague terms, but in ways that facilitate this kind of socioeconomic interdependency, social life, specialization. Yes, entrepreneurship is part of that. But, you know, there's sort of a social and physical embedding to the economy that often doesn't get called out. And when you don't call it out, you just think that a check and choice resolves the problem. But if there's no physical place to live, if there's no way to move around, if the neighborhoods are very segregated, then all that is defeated. So again, the economic choice is embedded into these social and physical structures that become very important and that typically are easier to see in a city, but they're really present everywhere when you think about national development. So at the same time, if you think what I said makes sense, and a lot of people would agree that you should develop infrastructure and so on, and education, then you have to ask the question backwards, which is, okay, you have all these things, but are people really enabled and encouraged to be creative, to be entrepreneurial, to specialize? Do they have enough, for example, of a predictable outlook? If the outlook is very unstable and people cannot count that by specializing or by learning something, they can actually, you know, have a good life and have a good outlook, then that doesn't work. You know, there are lots of stories of people with PhDs driving cabs in Europe, for example. So Europe has not always done very well. It's done very well at educating people, but it's not always done so well at creating the structures in which the education can, you know, be expressed socially, have value socially.
Do we know why?
Well, you know, this is a bit controversial and complicated, but it often misses certain structures, right? So like a complex system, you know, suppose that you live in a poor country and people go and study rocket science, right? Can they get a job there and contribute to economic growth? So usually not, right? They have to go to NASA in the US or somewhere. So there are things like this that are a little tricky, right? What does the network need and what does the individual want and so on? How good is the fit? So you both need knowledge that you can acquire through education, but you also need knowledge that fits and that can continue to be developed within a socioeconomic structure. And when the socioeconomic structure gets to be large and complex, there are many opportunities and almost any specialization can develop into something. But when it starts relatively simple, you kind of have to get there first. And so sometimes you actually end up exploiting talent because talent doesn't have the conditions, or education or whatever, doesn't have the conditions to
flourish.
To flourish there, exactly. That's a good word. This is a little tragic as well. I don't know if anyone listening to me has had this experience, you know, in my own life a little bit. But I've seen a lot of other examples that often, you know, when somebody goes to study, for example, I remember examples from Native American communities in New Mexico, where I was at Santa Fe Institute, that if somebody goes and becomes a brain surgeon or sometimes even a lawyer, could they come back and, you know, live with their community and in, for example, a reservation or something? And usually not. Once you take that education, it's also a commitment to staying away if you want to exercise the education. So you're very divided between your community growing up and your culture and yourself as a professional and the things that you enjoy doing. So that, to the extent that those things don't overlap very well, it's a little tragic. So I think there are sort of, you have to think about sort of the connective tissue that allows you to extrapolate from one situation to another. And again, in a city, because there's so many different specialities and a lot of the seeds are there, that's a little bit easier. But sometimes, you know, if somehow the fit is not good of the academic knowledge you acquire to what exists in a society, that cannot be productive. It's tough because people should be able to pursue what they want to do, right? But at the same time, then sometimes means that you cannot exercise it what you started with. And that happens a lot with advanced, you know, research and PhDs and so on.
And that's essentially the limitation of the network, isn't it? Or the infrastructure, shall we say, is such that you can't make that flourish. Just to finish, Louise, a question. What is the most surprising thing to you that's worked from a city development thing? What have you seen something that has been done that just shouldn't work, but it does? And then you begin to understand, oh, we missed that. That's why it works.
There are all kinds of things that are kind of very surprising. And that in retrospect, then you just go like, of course, I mean, why not? So there are things like, you know, even through COVID, right? For a while, people had to stay home and get food delivered. But then a bunch of cities, you know, New York became famous for this, but I think many other cities also did it. They had these wide sidewalks, pavements that no one is using. And then they started putting restaurants there, you know, allowing restaurants to open up spaces. And, you know, some of these cities, particularly American cities, they didn't quite have the same sidewalk culture that you have in Europe, you know, of cafes and so on. But boom, all of a sudden that became possible and it was a huge hit. And then it didn't go back. And it was done out of necessity, but in some sense, it was latent. I mean, these crazy American sidewalks, they're so broad. What's their best use? Is it to move people around? Is it like for people to enjoy the city? And so there it was, you know, and it was seen a little bit as an appropriation of public space by private businesses. And obviously, to some extent, it was. So it created a lot of issues and regulation and so on. But it really transformed the feeling of the city. And because people were so starved for spaces to socialize at that point, they really made a huge hit. Or you see this a lot with pedestrianization of certain spaces, not to say that every city needs to be completely pedestrianized, but when you do simple things like reducing noise, reducing, you know, just the risk of being run over by a car and so on, and create spaces, particularly central spaces that have population around them and so on, then you have all this life coming out of everywhere. It's kind of interesting and magical. So those things are simple interventions sometimes that don't even require a lot of buildup and planning and architecture sometimes can be quite simple. Other things that happen are soft interventions. A lot of cities are doing this with their new transportation systems, is that it's often difficult for people when you build something like a subway system or a metro system. When you build it for the first time, it's kind of a complicated space for people to navigate because it's very dense, it's often underground and so on. And people need to be socialized. They have to become its own civic space because people are packed in together, all kinds of issues of harassment, people littering, all kinds of things. And so it becomes sort of a learning opportunity or an opportunity for developing a civic spirit of people respecting each other. You know, so this becomes a little subculture, but a window into a culture of sharing a civic space. So this happening in India, happened famously in Colombia, that they actually had a civic police in the metro stations that kind of, you know, would boot people out that would misbehave. But that, you know, over time, this is not like police with guns. It was just like a police of make would have thought, right? In a place like Colombia, it feels more like Asian. But it was something that somehow allow people to learn the city. So things like that that are very sort of interesting that create culture effectively for the first time. There are many other forms in which culture is formed in cities in terms of people having tolerance and appreciation for difference, from art to fashion to all kinds of things. But again, creating these spaces, the sort of civic, benign places where people can appreciate and be driven and be fascinated by difference, they usually actually have a subtext of difference, diversity, but also change is good. And that moves the society to a different place. So those things are sometimes very simple, but you can kind of just see them. I was just in Beijing and I was fascinated. I mean, this is more the kind of things that China does, which sometimes are extraordinary, but they have a very handed policy on internal combustion engine, so cars and motorcycles. So now it's very, very difficult to get a license, therefore to get a new internal combustion car, and almost impossible to get a motorcycle. So all of a sudden, you get that all the motorcycles, they're not motorcycles anymore. They're kind of something in between a scooter and a motorcycle that's electric. And the city's very silent. It's just like, it's really nice because, you know, certainly here from an American city's perspective, it's very loud, it's very aggressive, very unpleasant. And now you're in a very dense city and, you know, has still a lot of human life and so on, but it's quiet. And it doesn't feel dangerous anymore. A lot of noise is a very emotional feeling for people. It's kind of the most emotional sense. So the moment you take that away, that pressure away, you know, people behave differently. So that's just a little example of things to come. I think this will come to a city near you almost surely. But kind of the fact that it happened very quickly, you not only see the physical and transformation in the motorcycles, but you see then a different feeling of space and of, you know, how... a feeling of alarm versus a feeling of relatively calm and so on. A lot of cities are greening their spaces too. So this is kind of sort of a transformation as well that you see. Even spaces, obviously this became an icon, but places like the High Line in New York where you travel, you know, it was a train line, but you're traveling a little bit over the city and it's a green space and a pedestrian place. It just creates this magical space that then just spurs all this economic development and real estate and so on around it. So cities have all these amplifications built in. So I like to say that it's not just cities, but cities, you see it very clearly, that things always happen in virtuous and vicious cycles. So things are either amplifying towards making things really bad or really good. And so if you're a good sort of urban planner, mayors often have a good intuition for this, you ride these tigers, you know, hopefully up towards creating these great virtuous cycles of change. But sometimes, you know, they're hard to interrupt. So these things where you place just the right seed, the right transformation, and boom, everything flourishes, they're really beautiful things to see. So I encourage everyone listening to think about their own examples. But this happens a lot, particularly now that cities are changing their technologies, they're greening, they're pedestrianizing. And then you see that the nature of space, but the feeling of people in space and to each other really changes.
Luis, thank you very much for being on the show.
It's a great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Simplifying Complexity, where we look at the key concepts of complexity science with expert minds from across the world. Concepts like emergence, self-organization, adaptation, networks, scaling, tipping points, and much more. This podcast was produced by Brady Haywood and Wavelength Creative. To make sure you don't miss an episode, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. I'm Sean Brady, and I'll see you in our next episode.